Hello, and welcome back to the Feeling Seen podcast, the podcast that talks about the movies that make us feel seen. I am, of course, your host, Jordan Cruciola, and I am here today with, as I welcomed him and as I introduce him to you, I am here with a legend. I am here with I'm here with the star of the screen, both big and small. I am here with somebody who in previous lives has been a theater director, a choreographer, a dancer, an educator, and someone who you might recognize from prestigious television, such as True Detective, independent films such as Blood Quantum. Maybe you're a big fan of that super universe on AMC and The Walking Dead and The Fear of the Walking Dead. And the show Rutherford Falls on Peacock, in which you play Terry Thomas, the very cunning and poised casino CEO. Michael Greyeyes, I could go on for a long time to properly establish your credentials here. But how is that for an introduction, Michael? Did I set you up adequately, or is there more we should put out there?
I'm flabbergasted. I'm gobsmacked. I don't know what to say, Jordan. Thank you very much for such a wonderful introduction.
Hey, all I said are things that you have done, so I'd be more impressed with myself if I were you.
Well, you know, if you know me, you know I'm a workaholic, so you work 30 years in a business and things start to add up.
Right, right, yeah. No, you've been working since the early 1990s. I mean, the world's changed much in the past 5 years in general, but like the world has also changed in its own ways in the microcosm of the industry. How has the past sort of 10 years compared to those earlier 20 in terms of like the pace of industry evolution?
Well, you're right. Everything has changed. I don't think it's because of the media, like the format. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I started, we were, you know, still using film and cameras. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was a kind of a rhythm. There was a certain process to the day. It was also special, right? Because it's like, we're rolling.
Yeah.
We're rolling. There's something kind of like organic happening. When we started shooting onto cards, things changed a little bit.
Yeah.
But it was still the basic same. It was the same work for me. Mm-hmm. It was the same work as an actor. You know, you have to, you know, understand your script, you have to understand your story, you have to understand your character, you have to understand the scene work and working with the rest of the cast and the director. So that hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. I think what's changed in terms of the body of work that I'm pursuing, mm-hmm. is the streaming model has created more opportunities. There's more shows. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's just more shows.
Yeah.
I remember when I first began, you know, like pilot season was really important because it was, you know, this is like, I hope I get a pilot. I hope I, you know, get some guest stars.
Yeah.
So end of January through April, you were like, you were in LA, you were mm-hmm. trying to make this thing work. But it was almost like it was cyclic, like work was cyclic.
Yeah.
Now work happens all the time.
Great and for a workaholic like yourself, as you established before. Excellent.
Yeah. And so for me, that's what's different. Mm-hmm. There's more work. And also, you know, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that I have opportunity. Mm-hmm. So I think it was with Woman Walks Ahead. It was after that moment, you know, because I was able to work with, you know, a director like Susanna White, mm-hmm. and Jessica Chastain and Sam Rockwell, that the conversation around me changed. Mm. And in our industry, power and visibility leads to other opportunities. So it's sort of like a neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like I was in a certain kind of neighborhood and then they said, oh, come to this neighborhood. And then I was in that neighborhood and that was a different kind of work. Mm-hmm. That was a different kind of access. So I've been really fortunate that, you know, I've made some really smart choices and the right projects came along at the right time. So it's really probably in the last 6 years that I've accessed some of the best roles of my life.
Well, and then, so getting to the meat of the conversation, get on the kind of like the topic of like growth points and origin stories, really like the character that you have brought for us to discuss today, it is the first repeat movie on the podcast for us. We are going back to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but this time we are discussing Chief Bromden, played by Will Sampson. Why have you brought this character to our doorstep today? What is the resonance of Chief Bromden for you? And of course, when did you first see the film?
You know, I can't exactly remember when I saw it, but I was like a tweener.
Okay, sure. So you were young. You were a kid.
I was young. Okay. I was young. I was a kid. And I don't think I understood it all. But I just remember that film was like, you know, it was one of the first truly independent films that I'd seen. Mm-hmm. You know, it was made outside of the studio model at that time. And I just felt it was a revolutionary kind of story for me, you know, at my age growing up in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And I was used to seeing Native people like in Westerns, but certainly not in contemporary stories. So it's sort of like myself and my family and my community were absent from mainstream media. Mm-hmm. But we did exist in these other kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. I felt that One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest centered a contemporary existence. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was a revolution. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, that's a Native man.
Yeah.
That's not a guy that is, you know, he's a pretendian.
Yeah.
He's a real Native person. And he's integral to this story. And the story's happening now. Mm-hmm. And so, that should be alarming, I think, to a lot of people.
When
you think it's like it's the 1970s. And that's when we see, that's when a major portrayal. Mm-hmm. That's when it's first introduced. And of course, people like Chief Dan George were doing incredible work. And there was other work happening, you know, before that and after that. But for me, that was the oh, wow moment. Mm-hmm.
That's such an amazing point to make of like, because obviously this is a podcast about where we see ourselves places and representation is the conversation or representation is at once like, obviously I think it's important. I'm doing this whole thing. But at the same time, like the capital R representation conversation can turn into one of those things where like, it's like the word badass for women has just turned into like a white feminism thing where you just saying it doesn't mean anything. It's supposed to encapsulate everything. It's like representation. And so I think that is such a special point you make about like the category of representation that you lacked specifically as a Native person, there was a way that it's like, if I'm there, I'm an element of history. I am an adornment in something that is a time that came before. I am not a part of the present. And if you do not see yourself rendered as a part of the present, it makes it so much harder to even to imagine yourself as a part of the future. Like to imagine something better is to imagine yourself in a place and time and see how you can grow and change and evolve and circumstances can improve. But if you're not even permitted the opportunity to see yourself in the present, that fucking robs people of like the capacity to imagine themselves in like a future iteration of society to even be better. And that's such a goddamn horrible thing. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's an anomaly too. Bromden was an anomaly because he was the only Native character in the story. So even though it was positive for me as an Indigenous person looking at it, it also set up certain kinds of tropes that I've been dismantling ever since. Like,
totally.
That there's, if there's a Native character, they're the only Native character. The play and the book, which, you know, I performed Bromden in a play for my thesis when I was in university, getting my master's. And I read the book as part of that preparation. Bromden is the narrator.
Yes.
Of the Kesey story and the Dale Wasserman play as well. Mm-hmm. He is the narrator. So he is actually more important in terms of how the story is told than Nurse Ratched or, you know, R.P. Mm-hmm. Murphy. He's the storyteller. Of course, that was excised from the film. So again, there's an erasure. Mm-hmm. And setting up this anomaly because, you know, in the book, it talks about his family and about his dad, and that's completely cut out of that film. So in the same way, you know, that film's landmark, it also introduced kinds of cheats, you know, that Hollywood has taken advantage of ever since. You know, yes, we have a Native character, but they're the only one. So we don't see them inside community. So that means that's like he's like the last of the Mohicans. Right. He's like the last one. We don't see the community. We don't see the fabric of our existence as we know it. Mm-hmm.
Well, having then been exposed to Chief Bromden in the film form, when you said you're about like a tween and then to perform that role more built out in its stage iteration in college, what were you sort of what were you determined to bring to that, that there was an absence of when you saw it on film, when you were like, this is my chance to be the fully fleshed out Chief Bromden? What was sort of like the way you wanted to more embody him than he was able to even exist as on camera?
Well, obviously there were like these incredible monologues, you know, that were part of the Wasserman play. And, you know, those were exciting because Bromden's insane. Like that's what makes that story mechanism so powerful, is that Bromden's actually very unhealthy, and he's a unreliable narrator, right?
Right.
So he's insane. And during the process of telling the story, he starts to become healthier again. So that was a crucial part of how I approached the performance. I obviously wrote a thesis about it. so there's a lot there. One interesting thing for me was the party scene, you know, in the play, the night that they celebrate escaping.
Yeah.
Right. Like the two sex workers come and Candy and her friend, and they end up getting wiped out. They end up getting drunk and they pass out, and then the nurse comes in. They're all like, they don't escape. Right.
Yeah. And the door, the window's open. Like the path to freedom is right in front of them.
And they all just, they pissed it away.
Yeah.
So one thing that was part of that is that Bromden's drinking. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, there's whiskey and they're drinking, and I've been very careful in the first part of my career. It's like, I don't want to perpetuate that kind of a stereotype.
Right.
So I was very, very careful about letting white audiences see me, a contemporary Native person drunk. And so I was like conflicted during that rehearsal process. And I was like, oh, what do I do? And I was like kind of like half in the scene, half in out of the scene. And then it all changed completely when I was like, actually, Bromden's the life of the party. He's the energy behind it. So once I stopped fixing an audience's perceptions of a Native man, then I was free to become an actor that functioned properly inside the piece. So that was a big moment for me. Yeah. And, that moment connects entirely to Wild Indian, right?
I was just thinking of that as like a perfect rejoinder to that conversation.
Yeah. Because that allowed me to go, I don't give a fuck what people think of Makwa. He's an awful person. He is so damaged, and he wreaks his havoc on people from a place of damage. And he's completely powerful in despite this, you know, this massive wake of destruction that he creates.
Just to note that Wild Indian is, it was a 2021 film that you starred in, that you are the lead of, about a boy, Makwa. We meet him at the outset in a very abusive home, in a very difficult environment, and he makes a terrifying decision as a hurt and scared boy that as we jump into the adult timeline of his life in which you are Makwa, you are accomplished, you are professionally successful, you have a beautiful wife, you have, you know, children, and you are hiding this terrible secret of what you did when you were younger, and you are sort of this like contained explosion of pure fury that seems to sort of have to wear the drag of composure to carry on oneself in the wider world, but have done so to the point of great success.
Look what I've made of myself, man. Do I look like the same fucking person?
Right, yeah. His mask was really a profoundly structured thing. And when I worked with Lyle, who was, you know, Lyle Mitchell Corvine Jr., who wrote and directed it, the cracks that started to appear in his mask towards the end of the film, that was so beautiful. And the ending, of course, like, was so open-ended. You were like, what is happening? What is happening to this man? You know, he was so destabilized as a human being. And it's easy to see a guy like that as a villain.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Jana, of course, my great friend Jana Schmieding, who plays Regan on Rutherford Falls.
She is so funny on Rutherford Falls.
She's so good.
That's the Peacock show you star in, about a small town in upstate New York that we enter into it, meeting Ed Helms, who's sort of the town mascot and the namesake of the Rutherford family. And he is running head to head with his desire to preserve his family's legacy and what his family's legacy represents when his great ancestors brokered peace with the native people and created the harmonious existence of Rutherford Falls.
Exactly. And so Jana, who plays Regan on that show,
mm-hmm.
she loved Wild Indian. She was like, that blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
She said, it's a film about the way our men hold their pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, okay, so that is what the movie's about.
That must be a very beautiful, I mean, that's a very beautiful thing to say. So I feel like that's a very beautiful thing to hear as the person who is carrying that sort of role and what becomes like inevitably that responsibility on your shoulders. That was something I was able to talk to Jeff Barnaby about when Blood Quantum came out, was how inevitably he's like, my existence somewhere is political as a native person. And I want to make a movie filled with cool shit. And a guy gets his dick bit off and you are in Blood Quantum, playing the outstanding character of Trailer amidst a zombie apocalypse. But at the same time, he understands that intrinsically, everything is going to be a metaphor for the socio-political norms of him talking about the issues of the post-colonial native man and dealing with the baggage of generations of trauma and what the world is like when you experience it as erasing you constantly. And he's just trying to make a fun movie at the same time. And here, you know, you are making, I read you referring to Wild Indian as your raging bull. And it's like, this is an incredible character opportunity. This is an acting opportunity. This is a story you believed in and a piece of artwork that you were like, I need to be at the forefront of this. But inevitably, it also becomes an act of responsibility because you are carrying the legacy of the native individual as a screen persona and having to like decide how you're going to subvert that and play with that. And that's a lot when you're just trying to do your goddamn job.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like, but at the same time, I'm also a person in the community, but I'm also an artist.
Yeah.
I'm an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I thought really that really guided me as I made that film is like, okay, so these kinds of parts don't come along that often.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, for lack of a better word, it's a star-making role.
Sure.
Because of its scope,
mm-hmm.
and what it asks an actor to do. And I said, I have to crush this. I gotta kill it. I gotta kill it. Because if we don't crush those opportunities,
mm-hmm.
Then people will be like, well, you know, it was not successful. It was
right.
Not great. And we're already working against notions that, you know, we don't have enough experience.
Mm-hmm.
We're not stars ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just elements inside the industry,
mm-hmm.
that have sort of put those ideas forward. We can't build a vehicle around a native guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to be like the friend,
yeah.
of the big star.
Yeah.
You know, so... one of my favorite moments, in response to that film was when Mark Ruffalo called me, somehow found my number. I'd worked with him, you know, on another show, and he called me and he just said, that was such beautiful work. I had to call you and tell you,
that's so nice.
Because he said, you put that, film on your shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, wow, that was such a great compliment, because that's what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what other leading men do.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's what Ryan Gosling does. He puts a show on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Mark did with I Know This Much Is True.
Yeah.
And that was my job. So as an actor, as an mm-hmm. artist, I was like, I have to carry a show. I shared that load with Chaske, of
mm-hmm.
course, who is a genius. And he was so good in that film.
He was outstanding.
You know, I'm really proud of that work. I'm really proud of what we were able to accomplish as performers, as actors. And also what it said to the world about the kinds of stories we can tell.
How did you find me?
Well, they're not hard. Just asked around for the fakest fucking Indian they ever seen.
What are you doing here?
What are you doing here? all the places. I'd never been to a place like this.
And there was an interview I was reading recently where you were talking about both Terry in Rutherford Falls, and you were talking about Wild Indian, and you were talking the phrase that you used was a heroic withholding of rage within each of those characters at certain points. And I think too, like, as we see the screen representation of Chief Bromden, I think what makes what we're supposed to align with, what is so sympathetic about that character, is throughout the movie there is almost this like heroic withholding of externalizing of how repressed he is and how imprisoned he is. And even like moments where we see McMurphy like literally riding him like a figure of entertainment, and there's this constant sort of withholding of a reaction, and that is what makes him somehow more noble, or that is what makes him like somehow our hope and the person we want to see walk out of the institution solo at the end. And I wanted to talk to you about like that notion of heroic withholding of rage and how it can work sort of, I feel like in a character like Terry, the heroic withholding of rage is something where we have to see where this character has to live within like the obligations of being a non-white person in a room to heroically withhold this rage to operate within the confines of like appropriate behavior. And then we see in Makwa a withholding of rage for the purposes of like existing in society, but in a way that kind of like subverts the idea of the noble withholding, because is it so noble to just not murder people, or is that just you doing the least? And then, right. And obviously the sort of silence that defines Chief Bromden as a screen character. And I wanted to hear about the various strains of heroic withholding of rage that you have seen and sort of just played with on screen as an actor yourself.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. It's great. When you look at Bromden, mm-hmm. You look at voicelessness. Like, he was silent for half the movie, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And then he's like, thank you.
Yeah.
I want juicy fruit. and you know, like, the first lines.
Juicy fruit. Boy, you sly son of a bitch, Chief. You hear me, too?
Yeah, you bet.
Well, I'll be God. Damn, Chief. And they all think you're deaf and dumb. Jesus Christ. You fooled them, Chief. You fooled them. You fooled them all.
So in a way, he was hiding in plain sight. And that, of course, is built into the character, and that's in the book, and that's in the play. Mm-hmm. He's hiding in plain sight because he doesn't believe in himself. He mm-hmm. believes he's too small. He's not as big as his father, yet he was a giant.
Yeah, Will Sampson's 6'7".
Yeah. And so that was an element, like withholding voice. When you look at Terry and you look at Makwa, mm-hmm. They're actually both empowered. Mm-hmm. They're both powerful. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'll contrast Bromden versus the two men. One is without power. His only power is to hide. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that he's not discovered. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other two are immensely powerful, in different ways. Mm-hmm. If you ask what the characters are trying to do, they're both trying to win. Makwa's mm-hmm. trying to win, and Terry's trying to win. He's trying to win in a small negotiation and a big negotiation on the macro level. He's trying to, you know, recreate the town and recreate this incredible, make this casino much bigger than he is. Mm-hmm. They're both ambitious. Makwa wants to win the game of life. Mm-hmm. They're like sort of like the Monopoly. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I want all of it. I want the home. I want the car. I want the beautiful wife.
There's that great moment where he's like, he's on the line for a promotion, and he looks at Jesse Eisenberg's in that movie, and he looks at him, and he just, with so much conviction, you're just looking at him, you just go, I earned this. Like, you see the deep belief and angry knowledge that he earned every step of this.
Yeah. And he deserves it.
Yeah.
Like, he utterly believes that he deserves it. And like, maybe he does, mm-hmm. you know? So both those guys are fighting for wins. Mm-hmm. And to me, what was withheld from the character and from the audience is the idea that Native people are actually very powerful. Mm. You know, rage is a component of these men. Mm-hmm. Terry's angry, you know, in his origin story, you know, he was pushed around, he was cheated, mm-hmm. and he wanted to like win at that game. Makwa was born into the wrong skin. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I don't like the hand I was dealt. I'm going to change the game in my favor. If you look at the dispossessed Native person on screen, mm-hmm. if you look at, you know, a person that comes from a dysfunctional family, if you look at a drunk on mm-hmm. the street or an addict on the street, what's hidden inside those stereotypes is powerlessness. Mm-hmm. So both Makwa and Terry articulate on screen what it means to be powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're more similar than dissimilar. Makwa hides mm-hmm. His emotional, like he, in a way he's 13 years old emotionally as an adult. Mm-hmm. Terry is actually emotionally whole mm-hmm. because he comes from a beautiful and empowering community. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Growing up, I didn't get to learn a lot of my traditional ways, but I did get to learn the great American pastime, which is power. Power, Josh, is a zero-sum game. If you have more of it, I have less. And then you can treat me however you want. If we want to ensure this tribe has a successful life, one that can maintain our traditions, art, and culture, well, it takes power. And unfortunately, power comes from money. The casino is a means to an end. It's the industry of this time. 400 years ago, it was fur trading. 50 years ago, it was manufacturing. And long after I'm dead, there will be Minnetonka figuring out how to master the next endeavor. Because that's what we do, Josh. Those of us who fight this battle, we do whatever we have to.
In that scene in episode 4, it's him holding his tongue in mm-hmm. order to achieve the win that he needs and that his community needs.
Right.
So that's the specific of like him withholding his anger. Mm-hmm. So they compare to each other, they contrast to each other.
Yeah.
But what I love about the three of them together is that although they're played by the same dude, mm-hmm. they're radically, radically different.
Yeah.
In all the nuances that I as an actor kind mm-hmm. of celebrate. So yeah, I think that's a great quote, but it scratches at the surface of other kinds of constructions.
Yeah.
That I'm so happy to talk about, right?
I'm exactly why I wanted to have you here.
Yeah. So, they withhold for different reasons. But I think the most important thing is the discussion of the media and Native men or Native people is that we've been withholding mm-hmm. portraits of power mm-hmm. from larger audiences.
Yeah.
And Bromden in a way is powerless mm-hmm. compared to more contemporary representations.
We have to take a short break, but we will be right back with more Michael Gray Eyes. And then later, I'll have one quick thing to say before I go about the new fantastic movie, Prey. So stick around, everybody.
Hey, it's John Moe, host of Depression Mode, a podcast about people's mental health journeys. Guess who we got? Guess who? It's Jamie Lee Curtis.
I look at life now as the game of guess who, which is simply the process of elimination. I know what I don't like. That's how I found out who I am.
Jamie Lee Curtis on addiction, show business, and fooling people, all on Depression Mode from Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Manolo, We have a show to promote. It's called Backdoor Game Show.
It's a family-friendly podcast where listeners submit games and we play them with callers from around the world.
Oh, sounds good. New episodes happen every other Wednesday on MaximumFun.org.
It's a fast and loose oasis of absurd innocence and naivete.
And are you writing a poem?
No, I'm just saying things from my memory. And it's a nice break from reality. Is that, are we allowed to say that?
I don't know. It sounds bad.
It comes with a 100% happiness guarantee.
It does not. Come for the games and stay for the chaos.
Welcome back to Feeling Seen, where I've been talking with actor Michael Greyeyes about seeing Chief Bromden in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as a kid, and then going on to play that role on stage and the choices and changes he's getting to make as an actor today. Let's get back into it. In the past couple of years, I've mentioned Blood Quantum, and obviously there's Rutherford Falls, and then there's Wild Indian, and these are works that you have been able to make with, it seems like, groups of people, where it has been a collaborative experience between fellow Native creatives, and not you perhaps acting as actor and consultant and seal of approval and et cetera. And I wanted to talk about sort of growing into that part of your career and the sort of demonstrated possibility of the present, where you don't have to be the only one on the set, and what that opens up for you just as an actor. Just as an actor, when part of your like emotional daily work is not being like, and I'm the only guy like me here. Like, how does that open you up creatively to just be in place and be these roles?
More than one would think, actually.
Do you physically feel it in your body when you're like standing on a set for Wild Indian, when you're in Rutherford Falls, knowing that I think it's like half the writer's room is Native writers from like various tribal backgrounds? Like,
I didn't feel it in those terms. Mm. I didn't feel it like, you know, physically or viscerally.
Yeah.
What it allowed me to do was what other good actors enjoy all the time.
Right.
Right. Is like, I was less burdened. I didn't have to carry as much. So when I play Terry, I love playing Terry, first of all, because he's hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And he's most often the smartest guy in the room.
Mm-hmm.
But what I love about playing Terry is that with Sierra having my back, mm-hmm. our showrunner, Sierra Teller Arnelis, with the writers having already created stunning, stunning strips.
Mm-hmm.
My job's really simple.
Yeah.
I just have to be a really good actor and do my very best.
Yeah.
Same with Wild Indian. I didn't have to worry about how Lyle would take a really kind of ugly representation of an Indigenous man.
Yeah.
I could trust him. I knew that he would balance it with what Chaske was doing, so that there's two competing ideas in front of a non-Indigenous audience about mm-hmm. what Native men are mm-hmm. and can be. So again, I could just be more Mokwa.
Yeah.
I could just be more intense or more driven or more violent mm-hmm. or whatever it needed to be in those instances, more menacing. So it just made my job easier. I just feel like I feel like I can run instead of like carrying like 10 things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the best reviews of my career are from Rutherford Falls and Wild Indian. And it's like,
You mean when I can just be an actor? I can do my best acting?
Exactly. So Benedict Cumberbatch, he's pretty fucking great.
He's pretty fucking great.
He doesn't necessarily have to lift the same kind of baggage that Sheila Tausi had to lift.
Nope.
Or Will Sampson had to lift, or I had to lift, or Tantu, or any other Indigenous actor.
Mm-hmm.
Because we weren't trying to fix British representation or, you know, white men you know, like,
yeah,
you know, like that was not our deal.
Mm-hmm.
We had our own deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was often, like, I don't think Benedict has to explain the white male experience to the people that he's working with.
Right. He doesn't have to worry about his character being defined against something that makes people more comfortable. And so we have to set that as a reference point at every turn. Yeah. Like, but what about this main thing that everyone's going to know and understand? So how about you just relate to the thing we know best? And like with Wild Indian, Rutherford Falls, it seems like there is not the concern of like, here's how we define against a quote unquote white normal. And then here's how we make everybody feel comfortable with the contrast to the normal. It right. is simply characters that get to yeah. be their whole selves.
And they get to be three-dimensional and they get to be paradoxical.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Terry is low-key terrifying.
Yeah, no,
that's
he's,
what I love about him.
Terry is frightening. When you get that look in your eyes and it looks like you could stab a person right through the throat in any second, I'm like, this is a comedy, so it's probably not going to happen. But I'm feeling yeah. that sense of possibility right now.
Yeah. So he's that. And then he's also a dad who just doesn't understand. Like, that scene in season one.
Mm-hmm.
With Gyawin Diehl,
uh-huh.
the actor who plays Maya, mm-hmm. his daughter. The scene when there's a 13-year-old speaking to her dad inside a truck, and they're trying to convince her to sell her beadwork, and she's like, no, why don't I just give them away for free?
Yeah.
Fine. Then no more allowance.
Fine.
And no more going to the Elder's Lodge to bead with Grandma.
Are you serious?
No, of course not. That would be mean. She's a very old woman.
Why are you so obsessed with money? Is everything like a deal to you?
Oh, good. The truck started because I put gas in it, which costs money because literally everything costs money.
Then why am I even in school? I should just quit and get a job at a sweatshop.
Maya, please. You can never keep up with those kids.
To me, that's like the most political scene of the whole season, because we don't see Native men having this kind of conversation with their teenage daughters
right.
in our media. And that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That is so normal, right? It's like, come on, don't you want to sell it? Like, we could do this thing.
Yeah.
And she's like, is everything about money with you? Like,
yeah.
What is your problem?
He's like, I'm the CEO of a casino. Yes, it is.
Right. So it's because we have Sierra behind the show
mm-hmm.
that I didn't have to fight for that scene to be
yeah.
written. I didn't have to fight for it to have, you know, took most of the afternoon to film it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it would be in the final cut. Like mm-hmm. I didn't have to fight and go, that's a really important scene. She, mm-hmm. you know, I know there's other scenes and
yeah,
I just knew that the story was in good hands.
Well, and I've read you speak too about like to this whole conversation, like the shorthand you're able to have with a director like Sydney Freeland, where you don't have to like there's not an experience gap between like how you see the world or how the world sees you that you have to explain why certain framing would make sense in ways. It can just be intuitive, like that she was you were talking about where she was talking about a scene with you and saying we, and you knew she knew what we meant. You were both talking about the same we in that situation. And then but you mentioned too that having Sierra in the executive position that she is, like that is so rare to like, yes, visible representation, need every, we need more intersectionality on screen, period, full stop, yes. But what the conversation, like, outside of, like, the consumer press kind of doesn't talk about as much is, like, yeah, but somebody needs to make the call in the edit bay. Somebody needs to be fighting with, like, studio suits and executive producers. And that those are the people that ensure those shorthands that you have with a director like Sydney Freeland make it to final cut and end up on a streaming show on Peacock.
Yes. And. Yes, and.
Yes, and.
When I work with Sydney and Sierra,
mm-hmm.
we don't often talk about cultural truths.
Mm-hmm.
They're assumed.
Yeah.
We end up just talking about doing better acting.
Yeah.
She does better directing. Sierra goes, with this line, do this. How about this for the scene? And we end up just having conversations about craft
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and about excellence and making things better. Instead of necessary, like sometimes it's purely technical talk.
Yeah.
And we can have the technical talk freely because everything else is, we come from the same places. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to also explain cultural nuance to each other.
Yeah.
We know what each other know.
We don't have to have a conversation about this thing to establish it as factual because we just know that it is.
Yeah.
God, what a time saver, right?
Yes. It's so much simpler and works hard enough. Like, it works hard enough.
So, like you said, some of the best reviews of your career have been in these very recent works you have done. The work you've been doing, like, you've been honing your craft over all this time, but, like, you're good at what you do and you always have been good at what you do. But with, you know, having something that feels like you're Raging Bull in A Wild Indian and then working in this, like, incredible zombie movie Blood Quantum, where the reservation of indigenous people are immune to the virus and it's the white hordes descending upon them to once again take what belongs to the indigenous people. And then in Rutherford Falls, you have a comedic turn. We have Michael Gray Eyes and a sardonically comedic turn. And it feels like, particularly with Wild Indian and Rutherford Falls, these feel like kind of new thresholds that you've been able to push into of late after 30 years already in this industry. So what is that? Like, obviously you're an actor, you show up, it's your job to do any character. What do recent works like this and collaborative relationships with figures like Sydney and Sierra, what do they indicate to you for, like, your imagination for what you sort of dare to want or that you know you will fervently pursue now that you've sort of, you know, I feel like it's exciting to push past thresholds when you've been doing something for 30 years because you're like, oh, shit, there's new stuff for me. I can keep finding new stuff. Like, what's the new stuff you're excited to keep finding for yourself?
I think what we've been making is excellent. Mm-hmm. That's so gratifying because there's lots of ways in which excellence doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And it's not because of lack of trying, right? Or it's not because all the people involved aren't fantastic at what they do and they're great at their jobs. But what we've managed to do with these shows is we've made really empirically, you know, I know it's a subjective business, but it's empirically really good work.
It's really good work, yeah.
And you might not like it, but you can't say it's not well done, right? So to me, what that's confirms for me is that our way of working has always been right. Mm-hmm. And it produces the kind of work that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Okay.
I just have to find the right ways of working and the people who want to work that way. Mm-hmm. So hot off the tails of this work that we're talking about, I've stepped back into my role as a director.
Okay.
And although I don't direct theater anymore, which was, you know, how I became a director, I just finished directing 5 of 10 episodes of a new show in Canada called Acting Good.
Oh, congratulations. Good.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So I'm the establishing director for a new show. Mm-hmm. Acting Good is made by the same network as Schitt's Creek.
Oh, so okay, great.
People know what they're doing. Yeah. And it's about a fly-in res, like a fly-in community. There's lots of communities in the far north where the only way you can get to them is by plane or boat. And so it's about a really isolated community, like, you know, 900 people and everybody knows everybody. So I directed this half-hour comedy because of my work on Rutherford Falls, watching how the directors work, watching how we work. They were really excited to have me come on board as a director and just go, okay, how did you guys do what you did?
Yeah.
Because we want to do something different.
Yeah.
But excellent also.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I spent, you know, 3 months in Manitoba with this project. Mm-hmm. You know, I just submitted my director's cuts. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it'll be on TV very soon, you know, maybe in the fall. So the next thing is also just expanding the core idea of excellence and the idea of creative control. Jana calls it, you know, a narrative sovereignty, indigenous narrative sovereignty. And so beyond becoming a director of film and, you know, TV, which is obviously something I'm very eager to pursue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To, you know, create franchises.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, to again smash down doors where doors had previously been closed.
Mm-hmm.
Sierra and I joked. She's like, she works so hard running, you know, making Rutherford Falls. She was like, I'm beat. I was like, it's okay. We don't sleep. The next ones
mm-hmm.
can rest a little bit. Mm-hmm. And she was like, good point.
Good point.
You know, because we don't want our kids to have to work as hard as we do.
Right.
And we don't want the next layer, the next iterations of creative artists to necessarily run into the same arguments
mm-hmm.
or, you know, obfuscations or whatever it is that we, you know, we deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So changing the decision-making layer
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
of Hollywood
yeah.
is the next step.
Yes.
So that Sierra isn't waiting and all of us aren't waiting for someone to go, yeah, you got another season.
Yeah. Yeah.
How great would it be for us to be somewhere in that lair?
Mm-hmm.
And we go, of course they're getting another season.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the other network exec goes, really? And then we say, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
And then there's no more argument.
It's the best idea and it's the right thing to do, as yeah. Rutherford Falls yeah. has yeah. has reinforced to me recently.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to relinquish you back out to the world, but Michael Reyes, I have so appreciated this conversation with you. It has been incredible to meet you and just hear, have your mind pour out into this podcast for an hour. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Wow. Thank you so much. It was an amazing conversation. Made me think about my work in different ways. So I'm happy for that.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you so much to Michael Greyeyes for that conversation. Season 2 of Rutherford Falls is out now on Peacock. It is a sincerely enjoyable time, you guys. I would recommend go find Peacock. Log into Peacock. Check it out. There's actually a lot of good stuff there. And actors are doing really great work. So check out season 2 of Rutherford Falls. And you can find the other films we talked about today. Wild Indian, Blood Quantum, Woman Walks Ahead. And of course, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on most streaming services. And now I have the one quick thing before I go. And that is, shout out to Prey. Like, let's celebrate Prey. The best Predator movie since original Predator. Yes, I know Predators, like Predator 2 is fun, you guys. I'm not hating on fucking Predator 2. Like, I'm not erasing its existence. I enjoy Alien versus Predator. Like, that's a good time. Take me into the H.R. Giger aesthetic of Alien and throw in some Predators. I've been having a good time with the Predator franchise for a very long time. But Prey feels like a return to that original cell of a feeling that, like, a Predator movie really wants to juice you up to have, like, that muscular action. That, you know, just, like, two people with a bro handshake, muscles flexing. That is what we get back in Dan Trachtenberg's Prey. And we get it because primarily because of little 25-year-old Amber Mid-Thunder putting this movie on her goddamn back as Naru and carrying it. Dakota Beavers is also amazing as her brother. This movie's just rad. If you like predators killing shit, if you like people fighting predators, if you like neon green blood, if you like people jumping out of trees, swinging axes at things in the heat of Mortal Kombat, Prey delivers. It's lean. It's mean. I think it's very cool that there is, like, the movie is performed in English, but on Hulu, where it lives, there is also a Comanche dub. As I understand it, the actors themselves came back to do the Comanche dub of it as well. So you're hearing the actors' actual voices, despite the fact that it is a dub in another language. I think that's really rad. And I just, like, I'm happy to see with how sort of bummed I was by The Predator, the movie that came before this, the like Shane Black with Sterling K. Brown. And, you know, it was like being at the worst party where you ended up. It's just like you're the only girl and it's a bunch of bros and they're like crushing beer cans against their heads and like making jerk off motions constantly. And like suddenly you find yourself in the middle of their circle jerk. Like that's what The Predator felt like. And there is such a wonderful return in this movie to like, there's nothing ironic about Prey. There's nothing winking about Prey. There's nothing like overly self, like postmodern self-aware about Prey. It's just good shit. It's just good shit. It's just hand-to-hand combat. It's a predator raising a bear above its head on its claw hands while it is invisible, and you can only see the discernible shape of the predator because the bear's blood starts to spill completely over the predator, giving it a defined form in front of you as like Amber Midthunder is backing away in terror before she, of course, will rise to fight the alien herself. It's a great time. And I have to say, too, a little shouts out to the movie Mohawk. If you liked Prey, I highly recommend the 2017 movie Mohawk, a nice little independent survival thriller in the woods. It is directed by Ted Gagan. He's also the co-writer of it. And it is about a young Mohawk woman and her two lovers, it's a love triangle, battling a battalion of American soldiers who are hell-bent on being fucking American soldiers. This is like late stages of the War of 1812. So this is, it's a really taut, high on ambiance and like mood in the forest and violent and brutal and mean. So if you liked what Prey was serving, I highly recommend going and checking out. Again, as we always say, support independent cinema, check out Mohawk, and go out there and celebrate Prey. It is Hulu. They're saying it's their biggest all-time release. I think they've said between television shows and films, Prey is the top. I'm so glad, Predator Nation, that you've been out there lying in wait in the tall grass to surface again for a movie that was worth your time and your attention. Would love if this movie just happened to spill over into theaters. I would 100% see it on a big screen. I would love to watch this movie multiple times, the biggest format possible. So yeah, shouts out to Prey, Amber Midthunder, way to crush it. And that is the show. We're going out on that great celebratory note. That is the show. You can follow us on Twitter at FeelingScenePod or send us an email at feelingscene@maximumfun.org. If you want to follow me, I'm Jor Crew on Twitter. Our theme music is by Andrew Epen. This show is produced by Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producers are Kevin Ferguson and Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.